bad. That's why I didn't want to come over right there.
Yeah.
I didn't call him in.
He tried to convince me of that, yeah.
Good morning. Let's go ahead and get started if we could. This is the second in a series of four public hearings concerning the conditions that were imposed on the recertification of the four different voting systems. Today, this particular hearing concerns the conditions imposed on the Sequoia voting systems. Since we're broadcasting on the internet, I think, and we're recording the meeting, let me do some preliminaries here. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State. Mike Kaufman is not feeling too good right now, so he's listening in his office. So, for the record, the date is March 6, 2008. The time is 10:04 a.m. The other folks here with me at the table to my left is Stephanie Sigelski, legal specialist with the Elections Division, and to my right, John Gardner, manager of the Voting System Certification Program, and to his right, Jerome Lovato, also of the testing board staff as well. And we're meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. With that, let me just give a little bit of background. I think we're all on the same page, but I think it's helpful to kind of go over kind of what the purpose and scope of the hearing this morning is. All of the voting systems were recertified with a fair amount of conditions, and we recognized from the beginning that the conditions that the Secretary imposed do create difficulties and additional work for the clerks. So it's been important to us to provide an opportunity for clerks and vendors to raise objections to the conditions, also to make sure that it was clear why the conditions were imposed by the Secretary of State. In other words, what deficiencies identified in the testing process are intended to be mitigated by the conditions. But we also recognize that those conditions perhaps may be difficult or not feasible, or perhaps the clerks in their expertise might have different conditions that might meet the same objectives as the original conditions. So we had after the December 17th decisions, we spent 4 hours with each of the vendors and interested county clerks going over the conditions that are set out in the overview binders, and hopefully that helped at least explain some of the background on the conditions and so forth. And then we also asked clerks to submit to us the problems that or their objections to conditions, either informally or through the formal reconsideration process, and we've been logging those. And with the passage of House Bill 1155, though, we really have another way to deal with conditions as well, which is what brings us to today's hearing. The Secretary would like to, as much as possible, address the objections to conditions under House Bill 1155 within the 30 days that House Bill 1155 provides. March 12th is the 30th day after the governor signed House Bill 1155. And the bill does say that the clerks need to know within 30 days, you know, basically what the situation is with their systems. So the goal is to try to address all of the conditions within the 30 days. But we've also recognized, and I think it was probably stated in the public notice, that if we are not necessarily foreclosing consideration of the conditions after that as well. But to the extent that we can deal with problems with the conditions, we'd like to do that by March 12th. So that's the purpose of the hearing today, is to focus on some of the objections that clerks and vendors may have. I do want to clarify one other thing that we've had questions about. The grandfathered equipment is not subject to the conditions. In other words, equipment that was purchased or acquired prior to May 28, 2004. So there may have been some confusion about that. But an awful lot of equipment is subject to those conditions. I have John Gardner and members of the testing board here because I know that it is hard to tell from the overview binder exactly how to relate the conditions to the particular deficiencies that the testing board identified. So what I'm hoping will work well if clerks identify particular conditions that they have difficulty with but don't really necessarily understand why those conditions are there, then we might be able to just ask Mr. Gardner or Mr. Lovato kind of what's the purpose of the conditions, and that might help us determine whether there's a better approach to the problem that led to the condition. So that's kind of what I'm hoping will come out of this is to some degree a discussion about the conditions and whether they're feasible and whether there may be better conditions or alternative conditions that might address the problems. I know in some cases, and I don't really know about this particular, I don't know particularly about Sequoia, but in some cases the hearings that we, or the meetings that we had in December and just the additional work that the testing board has done has led the testing board to believe that they know some things that need to be reworded on some of the conditions and updated and so forth. So as we go along, I think there'll be an opportunity maybe for Mr. Gardner to update us as well if there's something he's aware of in the conditions that need to be fixed or reworded or whatever, then I'm hoping he'll speak up or so forth. But I mostly want to focus on providing an opportunity for clerks and the vendor to raise the objections to the conditions. So let me just go from the sign-up sheet then, if that covers the preliminaries. The first couple of people have signed up, Ed Smith from Sequoia and also Amy Fordyce. And I don't know whether there's a preference on whether to start with the vendor. And I do it, and actually I have. There is a preference, Nancy? Oh, you're organized. Okay. Well, I'll turn it over to you then. Go in the order that helps the process. Thank you.
Yes, everyone has assigned duties here. First of all, I'd like to...
Oh, and Nancy, maybe just introduce yourself and who you are.
Okay, Nancy Doty, Arapahoe County Clerk and Recorder. And we have Sequoia Equipment, along with Lincoln, Elbert, and Pueblo counties. So, first of all, I'd like to give you a summary of the conditions and the ones that we are agreeing to and the ones that we would like to discuss. So... And of the 49 conditions listed, we are agreeing to 36 of them, so we don't feel there's need for discussion on those, which is 73%. The remaining ones we would like to discuss this morning, and we would like to start with software conditions, 1B. I don't have my glasses on, Mary. Maybe I need those. First of all, we would like to ask for your help in making us successful this year, because it's going to be a very difficult election anyway. So in our discussion with all of our counties and the vendors, some of these conditions seemed a little bit onerous for us. So we would like your help in making us successful. So software conditions 1B, which requires a second or backup copy of WinEDS database that is created immediately after the point of memory cards are downloaded. And then after the close of polls, the designated election official shall load the sealed backup copy of the database onto the server and proceed with the uploading of the memory cards. So our response to this is there should not be any modification to the server once the election has been set up. And memory cartridges have been created. Reinstalling a copy of the database at any time after this point only invites opportunities for errors, especially considering that all of the functions going on during election night. The physical environment around the server is in strict compliance with the Secretary of State Rule 43, which mitigates any concerns over a potential attack on the system. And also, there's a backup copy of WinEDS at the Secretary of State's office. So if there was any concern about the integrity of the system, this could be obtained and reviewed to see if there were any changes were made to the original database. Proceeding right along.
Nancy, could you explain just a little better? I was sorry if I just wasn't tracking quick enough. What's the danger in making the backup copy? What's the
we
risk?
There is already a backup copy that's stored at the Secretary of State's office.
Okay.
So there was another backup copy, to my understanding, that you wanted us to do something with. Is that correct? Okay.
And I'm sorry, I just thought I heard you saying that might create a risk not present.
We'd have to look back at that exact wording. Ed, sure, come on up, Ed.
Good morning. My name is Ed Smith with Sequoia Voting Systems. To further build on what the clerk has to say, the restriction requires restoring a SQL database, which is a very complex, not a flat file database with what's called referential integrity, meaning that things interlock and they have to be just so. And these databases can be as big as a gigabyte of information. And during this restoration process that you're going to do at 7 o'clock at night, when the polls close and election judges are calling in because they need this, cartridges and results are going to come in, the media is wanting to make their deadlines for the 10 o'clock news, you're going to restore this database, which is a complex process in and of itself. And if it blows up, and it blows up their servers, whose else's phone is going to ring? It's going to be the people in this room and around this table and the secretary's office. So we believe that an acceptable answer to mitigate the security concerns of the test board, as well as give the clerks some ability to manage the risk of carrying out this database restoration, is to do it early on in election day.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, John Gardner. I think the testing board would be agreeable to allowing the county to do the restore process at any point on election day rather than after the close of polls, if that's acceptable.
Now, does that help? It sounds like on the
one
hand,
we're already working with that database during the process, are we not, Ed? When we're reading the ballots up to that point?
Yes, you are.
Yes, so why would we do it on election day then, too? To disrupt our whole process.
Can you explain the process why you would be using the database prior to election day? Just to explain that.
I'm not the techie person here, and John Vecino is very ill, but perhaps Ed would like to come and talk about that again. Mike, you want to talk about it? Who would like to address that?
Well, let me just, maybe I could clarify this, John Gardner again. My understanding would be that you would be processing either early voting data or mail-in absentee ballots. And that information,
that's right.
Okay. So from what I understand, the 400C and its application would be used, not the WinEDS database, for processing absentee and mail-in ballots.
I just know, John, there's a whole lot going on election day, and to do this complex process would be a burden that I don't think is necessary. As we said, we already have a copy at the Secretary of State's office. Why would we want to jeopardize our election?
Sure, and I can address that. The copy at the Secretary of State's office is an escrow file of your election setup records.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine, and there are purposes for having that escrow data. But as you are processing your election and doing different things, certainly an event could take place where you would modify the database. You may download more cards. You may cancel a card that's already downloaded. You may remove a machine from your inventory that's inside of that database, because you have to make those changes and have that flexibility. So during those points, the forensic value of our escrow file does no longer matches your election set up on your WinEDS server. So we're asking you to make a backup of that copy. Just keep backing it up, storing it off. But when you go to upload the results, to restore the database that's in that sealed, protected state. Because forensically, we wouldn't be able to analyze the escrow copy to your copy. There is certain value still in that escrow file, but it doesn't have that same security that we're looking for from the failures that took place during testing. We have walked through the process of restoring the database through SQL, and it doesn't seem that complicated. I'm not sure what failures you could experience. I mean, we've conducted it multiple times in testing.
Would you like to come out and do it on election day?
I would be happy to. I mean, the process is very detailed through the Sequoia documentation.
And yeah, okay. Would someone like to add to that? Okay.
Matt Crane, Operations Manager, Arapahoe County. John, while I'm not thoroughly familiar with the process, I think one area where we might have to do that is when we bring, if we were to use the Edge machines during early vote and we had to come back and reset them for Election Day, there may be a scenario where, you know, where we'd have to rerun the memory cartridges and download that information. But also, you know, I would also question why what's currently in Rule 43 wouldn't suffice. As far as the security goes, if we're in strict compliance with Rule 43, I believe that it should mitigate any other concerns over any potential attacks, so thus making, you know, this particular condition unnecessary.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, you mentioned forensics just a second ago, and that popped an idea into my mind. You know, there are tools, third-party, readily available tools, ADEPT SQL, ADEPT SQL, that in fact we use to check on some things at times in our development processes, that would allow you to very quickly, on the order of 5 or 10 minutes, a database check the integrity of the databases as deployed at any stage of the election cycle relative to your trusted copies of our default databases that you already possess. And so I'm wondering, with that sort of capability, is this really a necessary piece of the election cycle and securing the election cycle? Would it be easier, simpler, and actually more to the point of your ability to assure the security of the elections to simply have the counties provide you a copy of the database? It would be time-stamped, so you would know that they took that snapshot at the point that you wanted in the cycle, deliver that to the test board, and you could analyze it suitably during the canvas period, 5 or 10 minutes of database, and assess that, yes, nobody had tampered with the stored procedures, functions, triggers, and the things that make the database really what it is and how it works and how it assures an accurate election count. So a suggestion. Thank you.
I don't know, any further comment or question, or should we go on?
We were just discussing. I think we could put some flexibility into this section of the rule to allow for a few different options, and we'll look at how to do that with
great
some other forensic tool.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Do you want to go on?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. 1C software conditions. 1C print results report after reading each cartridge, or create individual databases for each cartridge. We're saying that both options are really unworkable on election night. The process of printing a report after each upload of a cartridge is not realistic nor necessary. It would create chaos on election night. First, in regards to option one, Arapahoe County, we have 1,390 cartridges that we would have to upload and then print reports for that. It would greatly delay the work involved in tabulating the results. Denver County has a similar number of cartridges that they would have, that they've worked with in the past. Plus, we reconcile the total votes on the cartridges to the total votes, voters at the polls and during the canvass process, and we believe this would identify if vote tallies had been fraudulently compromised. Thus, we feel incremental reconciliations are just too confusing and serve no extra purpose. In option two, you're suggesting two master databases are being processed at the same time, and this would mean 2,780 uploads in Arapahoe County. And currently, our system identifies each cartridge as it is uploaded and alerts the technical person should the cartridge not be reading properly. Nor can cartridges be read twice, as all are individually coded to the appropriate voting machine. The system also tracks what cartridges have and have not been read. In addition, any concerns regarding attacks on the system are mitigated by physical environment around the server as required by Rule 43. Okay.
Any comment or question or something?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know that this requirement, the two different options here, pertains as much to the physical environment, the security of the system, as it does to trying to set you up for the changes that have been proposed for the audits. So having these reports ready allows that audit to go all the way back to WinEDS, where previously it was just kind of a machine-level auditing. What we have talked about would be to not require the processing of this on election night, but to make it part of the canvass, consistent with the other post-election audit requirements. You would still be required to do the same process, but you wouldn't have to do it on election night. You could do it at a time where it's, you know, a little more comfortable, because we still think uploading the cards, even if it was a second copy of the database, you're still going to get the same data, and you're still going to be comparing the same results. It's just at a different time period.
So are you suggesting that we run reports or rerun all the cartridges again after the election night?
Yes, I think that would be correct. If you were unable to get the reports out of the system directly, yeah, you would have to reload the cartridges. Now, on the cartridges, I mean, this would also help you out, too, because you're mentioning uploading 2,000 cartridges, which includes the Advantage machines.
Right.
Right. And I think if you did it on election night, that logic kind of makes sense. But if this was a reprocessing of cards, this really only applies to the Edge 2s and the 400s.
Okay.
So that would cut down the number as well. So
that would be 225. Which is certainly more workable than nearly 3,000.
One-tenth, yes.
Maybe we could have further discussion with that after we think about it a little bit. Yeah, it would be part of the canvass, which would slow up the canvass process, but I guess, you know, you're assuming then that we would be using all of our DREs, our old equipment plus our new. So it seems to me then that we're rerunning cartridges for part of our equipment, not for the other part, correct? So then why would that be necessary to do it for part and not the other? That's my question.
Yeah, I guess the answer is we're only able to dictate the conditions for the equipment that was tested mm-hmm. as part of the certification package, so we can't really impact the grandfathered equipment. I think that was Bill's statement. Ideally, it would probably be preferable because those Advantage machines don't have VPET and an increased audit on them would be advisable.
There is a paper trail internally.
There is an internal paper mm-hmm. trail, but it's not a voter verifiable paper trail.
But still, there's other things that we do. We reconcile the voters that come in. So there's so many checks and balances that we do. And this would be one little tiny part of it that would not verify the number of voters that have come into the polling site anyway. So I guess I may disagree with that logic, John.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The next section will be Ed.
And Mr. Smith.
Once again, good morning, and since this is actually my rehearsed or designated time to speak, I'll introduce myself a little more formally. My name is Ed Smith. I'm with Sequoia Voting Systems, where I'm Vice President of Compliance Certification and Quality Assurance. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to come up and comment. And Mr. Secretary, although you're not here, good morning. My comments are on WinEDS to the Ballot Production System, or BPS as it's commonly abbreviated, and a software tool that we've been called the Bridge, which is utilized to take some portions of the BPS database into WinEDS and avoid the need to manually or hand key enter that data. And I have provided to the people on the dais a couple of handouts. I gave them to Mr. Gardner earlier. I don't know if he has distributed those. I'll give him a second to do so. Many Sequoia customers throughout the country use a workflow, particularly if they have optical scan and DRE in the polling place, which is a common and increasingly common configuration to using BPS ballot production system to lay out their optical scan ballots. And BPS is, in fact, a standalone application to lay out ballots to the OpTec format, which Sequoia and other optical scanners in the market utilize. It's very very commonly known here in Colorado as well as around the country. They then take that information and proofed ballot layouts and migrate some portions of that information into the WinEDS database using the Bridge, which I'll describe here in a little bit. As we have been provided from the test board, there are three reasons why there are these restrictions on use of the BPS software and the Bridge, and they tend to focus around the fact that these products contribute to the election database that's in WinEDS, that they're not certified, and that since this is vendor-provided software and the vendor is a quote-unquote untrusted source, it cannot be brought in as some kind of off-the-shelf product or otherwise trusted piece of software. I have brought to the table some fairly recent information that you'll see dated, and I'd like to refer you first to the email, which looks like this and has my name at the very top, and particularly page 2, which is a letter to a citizen from Mr. Brian Hancock, who is director of the Voting Systems Test Program at the United States Election Assistance Commission. And I'll just go ahead and read it for the benefit of those people who cannot look at it. John, my understanding is that BPS is an optical scan ballot formatting and typesetting program. It also has the ability to input and manage candidate filing, meaning that you can put candidate names in and have them appear on your optical scan ballots without having to type them in duplicate places. The output of this program are inspected by election officials to ensure the correct geographical boundaries, candidate and contest information, spelling, etc., are produced. The Bridge is described as a software utility that provides one-to-one mapping of information from the BPS database to the WinEDS election management system. This mapping function is also checked by election officials. It is very clear that voting systems seeking certification and incorporating these functions would require testing of those components under the 2005 VBSG, and I put that emphasis on the number 5. As noted below, and he provides an excerpt from that 2005 standard, and I note for the record that our system is seeking or has been certified federally to the 2002, and we seek Colorado certification under those same auspices of the 2002 standard. The definition of a voting system is somewhat less clear in the 2002 VSS, which is short for voting system standards. And so at this point, we, emphasis mine, the EAC, have not required that these two items be submitted for testing to the 2002 VSS. I have been informed by Sequoia that they are currently working to fully integrate these functions into their products, which will be put forth for testing and certification of the 2005 VVSG, and for the record, I submit that that is true. As you know, there are practical problems to be faced when certifying products such as BPS and the Bridge. These include determining whether or not to require certification for all companies doing ballot printing in the United States, since they all use some sort of software, and Mr. Hancock has a parenthetical note, and the logistics behind such a determination, as well as the current voting system manufacturers. An even more complex issue is what to do about certification of statewide voter registration databases, since these systems are becoming increasingly more interactive with voting systems. As you may also know, the TGDC, which is the Technical Guidelines Development Committee, which is a committee of the EAC, determined that writing standards for voter registration databases was outside their current scope of activity. The EAC, however, certainly understands the importance of moving to develop such standards in the future and is currently working with the states to determine the best way to proceed. This will, of course, require substantial additional resources, both human and financial. Subsequent to that, and I turn your attention to the letter dated February 7th from Jan Brewer, Secretary of State, State of Arizona, where she stated to a citizen aligned with the citizen who was inquiring of the EAC, I have completed my review of your letter dated November 23, 2007, in which you alleged that the ballot preparation system, BPS, used by Maricopa County may not have been properly tested and certified at the federal and state levels, and they cite Arizona statutes. As noted below, the BPS software is not required to be certified, and therefore I consider this matter closed. And she restates some of the similar points to Mr. Hancock at the EAC. Frankly, at this point, we see the use restrictions on BPS and the bridge as unnecessary and having no basis. At the time we started the certification, somewhat less than a year ago, this information was not present. And I do not believe that the test board erred in any way in their determination after reading Rule 45.2 and the Colorado definition of a voting system, as well as their interpretation of the 2002 and 2005 voting system standards and guidelines. However, this new information makes it clear from the EAC that these products do not require nor merit federal certification. And if you say that they do, then, of course, as Mr. Hancock points out, what about the probably hundreds or thousands of ballot print shops around this country, some being probably one-person operations all the way up to very complex and sophisticated operations that are using, in many cases, homegrown software to develop ballot layouts? Ballot layouts are checked extensively by the jurisdictions. There's no question about that, and I'm sure they could detail how they do that. It makes sense. No one wants a voter to go to the polling place and have a ballot that has improper contests that they're either not eligible to vote for or are missing, or misspell a candidate's name. I just can't think of anything that would hardly be more unfair to a candidate. Colorado, of course, is tightly coupling its voter registration system to the voting systems. And so, as Brian Hancock points out, where do you draw the line? Where should those perhaps be certified? If BPS and the bridge are not allowed to be used, then you are going to force counties to hand key that information in. And if you think about the human error that will be produced from that and the possible security risks of having a malevolent actor in this key punching process, I just can't imagine why this would be restricted relative to having an automated piece of software that we have expressed our willingness to escrow with the test board for later analysis if it's anything very strange, and for which the output is self-evidencing and QA'd extensively by the counties in the form of their ballot layouts and the ultimate databasing activity that goes out with the touch screens and with the optical scanners. Of course, if we do go with hand key, then I think that the hand key people should be certified. But I'm not sure of a test protocol or certification protocol for people key punching in data. Regardless of whether they're certified or not, there's going to be errors made, which then will migrate their way through the rest of the workflow.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Let me just see. I want to make sure we get all the information out we need. John, are there questions or comments?
Sure. I don't think I'll ask questions, but I'll probably just comment on a few things. The issue that we take is not related to the 2002 standards or the 2005 standards. Colorado has implemented a process of trusted build, and that process involves having software that is proprietary by the voting system manufacturer to be federally certified and federally tested to become part of the voting system. So in cases where you have components of software, whether the EAC decides it's necessary or not, it's still proprietary software, and under Rule 45, that proprietary software has to be certified at the federal level to be used as part of the voting system. There could be opportunities for flexibility on this if the output file, which I'm not sure, is it a maybe this is where my questions would be, the output from BPS, is it a static file? And maybe the bridge is part of the confusing piece, because you, to make this happen, to make it allowable, you essentially cannot put proprietary software on the WinEDS server that is not federally tested and qualified as part of the trusted build. If you could use some kind of data entry, I'm sure it would be a human process that they would data enter into the BPS system. If you could export some file out that WinEDS could import without having some software interface between the two systems, then that could be evaluated. You know, if it's just a standard text file, the testing board could look at that, because now it's just an import-export deal, which is what I believe the SCORE system is setting up, not an actual software interface between two systems.
Okay. So you're saying basically that this is driven by the wording of our Rule 45?
Correct. We modeled the trusted build concept, the whole premise of the trusted build, off of what the EAC is doing, and this is one of our major security background. The fundamentals of security lies in the trusted build by protecting and verifying what happens to the software on those servers. But the introduction of a non-certified component that's made by the same manufacturer calls into question the validity of the trusted build for that system.
And why is that? I mean, it's still part of the trusted build, isn't it? I mean, it would be. But you're saying the problem is that it's not federally certified.
Right. We can't make, we don't have a tool to make it part of the trusted build because it's not federally tested.
Oh, okay. All right.
So then, Mr. Garner, based on one of your comments about it being placed on the server, if these tools were used offline, for instance, if I'm a small business doing ballot printing for one of the counties, and I've got my homegrown software that I had somebody, some consultant write. Obviously, that's not placed on the county servers or anywhere near them. If BPS, for instance, and the bridge were used offline from the production server of the county, and then the input, the filled now WinEDS database filled with the data from BPS imported into it, were then taken and run through your security procedures with a trusted database once it was completed. That database placed on the county's central count production server, would that satisfy the issue that you have? Because now it does not interact with the trusted build devices. Once again, the output of same software being fully self-evident.
Say that last thing again.
The output of BPS and the output of the bridge as it fills the WinEDS database with, for instance, candidate names, their ID numbers in the database, some of the geographic information around political subdivisions. Those are the things that BPS puts into WinEDS. And the bridge is simply a one-to-one mapping program. If there are candidate files, a list of candidate names in the BPS database, it simply takes one at a time and puts it into the appropriate place in the WinEDS database. And then it takes the candidate ID number that's associated to that name and once again populates that table of the database, and it's limited. Because even after you utilize, and if you utilize BPS in the bridge, you still have to put in a number of things, the machine serial numbers, the polling place addresses if you code your election by address, by location. Just a number of things have to subsequently be put in. Generally speaking, the counties can carry that from election to election, so they're not keying in 1,000 different polling place addresses every election. They carry that through and only deal with the exceptions. However, of course, candidates, contests, whether it's a primary, not a primary, if so, how many political parties and what are their names, those change every election, and those are what you generally would bridge in, rather than have people hand enter it in and, for instance, misspell party names, misspell candidate names, type in the wrong address for a polling place, get off one line in a list of 1,000 polling place addresses, and just generally botch everything up.
Okay. Thank you.
So I guess back to my original question. If this was done offline from the county's production server, would that be an acceptable compromise position?
I think the answer depends on what the output is. I mean, you mentioned an output in the form of a WinEDS database, and that would probably not be acceptable. But if it's an output in the form of a flat file that could then be used by the county to import through WinEDS, then that's a different scenario, because we're just talking about a text file. There's no scripts. There's no code associated with that.
At this time, the architecture does not support your concept. Essentially, you have the BPS database, you fire up the bridge in whatever manner, and that information then is taken directly from one to the other. And you start with a WinEDS default database, and you end up with a WinEDS database containing some portion of the election definition, based on what you can get out of an optical scan ballot.
Can I ask two follow-up questions?
Yeah.
Is my assumption correct that to enter this data into the BPS system, that is a hand-keyed process?
I'm not entirely sure. I believe that some aspects of it are, indeed. I suspect that the information that comes out of the voter registration databases is imported, which would be your geographic information system. I suspect that that is imported, and considering the complexity of that information, you would certainly not want to hand key that. Okay. But other aspects are hand keyed, yes.
Thank you. Second question. Isn't it true, from my understanding of your system, that there is a template file and an election file? And in that template file, the county could have a static listing of their polling places, and that would be used globally for the county regardless of the election. Therefore, re-keying the polling places would not have to take place for the next election. They could just reuse that template file for multiple elections, right?
That is correct. As I mentioned, that sort of information that carries from election to election is generally not hand-keyed, only the exceptions.
Thank you.
Anything further on this one?
No, sir.
And let's go on to the next one then.
The next section has to deal with the insights in Pueblo County and Elbert County are going to address those issues.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah. Amy Fordyce, Elbert County Clerk and Recorder. And I'm going to address the precinct's county scanner conditions for the Insight and the Insight Plus. And I'm going to do condition number 2 with external battery backup of the UPS device required. We believe this is an unnecessary expense due to Rule 43 and specifically under 43.8.8, the emergency contingency plans for voting equipment and voting locations. You guys are already requiring us to have a backup for at least 2 hours. So we're wondering why the discrepancy in the rules into the new conditions and why we would have to do that for the cost for the county. And then also under Rule 43.10, we also have to include a security plan in case of an electrical power failure. And I guess if we're looking at something that's already 3 hours, then we better be looking at having another polling site if it's going to be for that long anyway. Also, the voter is still allowed to vote if the power is to go out. If we're having paper ballots, they can vote that paper ballot and put it into the auxiliary bin of the Insight. After the close of polls, our judges, which would be one from each party, would take out those ballots and run them into the machine, and they would be counted as they normally would if the power was in place. So I guess our question is, we're not sure why we would have to go for the extra expense to purchase for 3 hours.
Okay. And maybe Mr. Gardner, can you respond to that question?
I can, yes. The requirements for 3-hour battery backup under continuous use falls under Rule 45.5.2.3.19A.
So why? And the underlying question is, what would be the harm then I mean, if you just simply collect the printed balance, I'm trying to think that through. You know, they could be run later. I mean, I guess we're avoiding the protections of undervotes and undervotes if we're not able to run them through at the time. I mean, you know, and that's important, but I don't know whether there's other considerations or not.
But there's still a discrepancy in then your 45 to the 43 rule. Then they're asking 3 hours, and in here it's only stating 2 hours.
That is possible.
Okay. Right. So I guess we're going to need an answer, because the cost of this to the counties, especially Pueblo and myself, we got an estimate yesterday, and it's going to be $640 per machine to add this onto our machines. So it's an extra expense, you know, to go to 3 hours and add an expense.
Can you provide a copy of that?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
And so I didn't pick up on that. You're also saying there's really a conflict between what Rule 43 says and what Rule 45 says.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Gilbert Ortiz. I'm Pueblo County Clerk and Recorder. Pueblo County doesn't have these Insight machines yet. We're planning on buying them in the future, but we wanted to come and argue some of the issues we had with conditions. Our issue is with the device level administration functions requiring access involving the use of keys, memory cards, and passwords must be restricted to a single person entry and detailed logs. You know, while I was on the watch list from the Secretary of State's office, it was for signature verification. When we started doing the signature verification this last year in 2007, we made the decision to have two people present, one from each party, making the decision on every signature that was going through our county. That, we thought, was an extra line of defense against somebody having any kind of prejudices on the elections. And per the U.S. Election Assistance Commission Quick Start Management Guide, dated September 2006, it is highly recommended that members of the election staff work in pairs whenever possible. This procedure will greatly reduce the potential for accidental errors and virtually eliminate any opportunity for deliberate mischief or fraud by a rogue employee. So I wanted to look around and see what other, you know, military and other people that were using, you know, two people for security. So I found a little piece in military security where it talks about military silos for nuclear weapons. And in each one of those silos, there are two people, both with the key, both with the access code to prevent any kind of one person making a decision to launch any of those nuclear weapons. So I guess I would ask why, in this case, when we're asking a mortal person that who could be hit by lightning, and I think one of us talked about earlier, win the lottery, would we give just one person all that powers?
Okay, thank you. I do recall this from our December meetings as well. I don't know whether there's anything further to ask about or comment, Mr. Gardner.
Yes, thank you. We've done additional research on this as well, and we're amicable to changing it to two person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to move along to the central count, 400 C's. Comments there are the conditions. The external battery backup required. We're suggesting that that currently the 400 C's do meet the federal standards, and the extra cost that would be involved. I think we've kind of already discussed that, so do we need to talk more about that?
I don't think so. Is there anything different? Any different considerations? Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
And then moving along to 4B, additional post-election audit functions to accommodate security deficiencies. We find this requirement excessive for several reasons. First, it's our understanding that the 400 C's were tested and found to be accurate in their tabulation of votes. So we assume that these additional requirements are due to security reasons rather than for accuracy. It's our belief that the security procedures we have in place were not given consideration during the testing process, and therefore we submit that we follow Secretary of State Rule 43, and those procedures need to be considered when determining whether or not additional conditions are necessary. As we all know, elections are a process, and no one piece of equipment can be evaluated independently of the procedures in place. Tamper-proof seals would alert us to fraudulent access. We have 24-hour video, 24/7. We have backup tapes of those. There's required to have to enter the tabulation room where the 400 C's are. You have to have access by key cards, and that's very limited to a certain number of people, managers. The facility itself, where this equipment is stored, is locked 24/7, and it has an alarm system in place. And access by the key cards, you can go back and print audit logs on those, find out who's entered and who has had access to those rooms. And workers that during the whole entire election process are only given limited access to various areas, not the entire building. So that was our first comment. Secondly, the current post-audit levels of 5% already exceed requirements for many other states. Currently, California is 3%. If the post-election audit currently is required to determine the accuracy of the election, then why would we want additional manual counts to be required? We feel this is supposed to address security rather than accuracy. Third, we only have 17 days to canvass and certify the election, and it's difficult to meet all the requirements currently in place by the deadline. We have provisional ballots. Is it on? Okay, sorry. We're working with unsigned or problem signatures, reconciliations, post-audit testing, and to impose additional manual counts would not be possible to complete in the time frame now required by the statute. If the closest race in November 2008 general election is a statewide race and the difference is 0.5%, with a turnout of 270,000 voters in Arapahoe County, the number of ballots to be hand counted in this audit would be 32,400 for Arapahoe County. Denver County calculated that for 0.1% difference and 250,000 ballots cast, it would require 3,000 man-hours, which translates into a crew of 75 workers working 5 days at a cost of approximately $36,000. And that assumes that they're only doing it once. You know, they have to get the count right, which would be awesome. Also, does the manual count mean that only the one race is manually counted, or would we have to recount the entire ballot? Either way, it would take months to complete. And I believe Sequoia, Ed, has a comment.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. I would like to ask you to look at another handout that I brought. This one entitled, or the first page is entitled Table 1, Sample Size Code Letters. If that's not enough to put you to sleep, I don't know what is. This table is from the American National Standards Institute Standard Z1.4, which is sampling by attributes. And since votes are attributes, you either vote for one or the other. They're not variables, meaning you could have gradations of a vote. That standard is applicable, and that is an American national standard. It is used across the country where quality assurance and quality inspection techniques are in play. These tables are used to assess essentially what we're here to talk about today with regard to the number of ballots that would need to be recounted to assure the accuracy of an election. And I'll speak to the security piece in just a minute. based on the margin of victory or loss in a given contest by a given candidate or proposition answer. In short, if you look at the first page, sample size code letters, you see numerous lots or batch sizes starting at 2 and going all the way up to 500,000 and more on the left. And you see all these different S codes and then Roman numerals 1, 2, and 3 for general inspection levels. They define levels of tightness of the inspection. Because of what we're doing here with an election, the general inspection levels apply. And I'd like to use, for instance, Roman numeral 2, that column, A through Q. The way that these tables are used is actually quite simple, as belies the apparent complexity. The state would define, for instance, a code letter or range of letters that would be used based on how tight they wanted to review or wanted the sampling plan to be. From that knowledge of the letter, the counties simply come up to the left table to lot or batch size. And for this example I use today, 25,000 ballots would be at issue in a particular need to perform this manual count. And so if you look, there is a lot or batch size range from 10,001 to 35,000. 25,000, of course, fits very nicely in the middle of that. And if you go to the column of Roman numeral 2, you get letter M, which would be in the range of letters or columns that the state could provide. You would then go to the second or third page of my chart where you have normal inspection and tightened inspection. Normal is when things are going normally. You've had for instance, if this was a manufacturing situation, a supplier that has been providing you with good quality product, or in the case of events like this where you don't expect any anomalies to occur. Tightened, on the other hand, is where perhaps you could expect anomalies, or you're a little bit nervous about that, or it's a more critical situation, you would use the tightened page, which is what I'll stay on for the remainder of this example. You would then go down to letter M under sample size code letter, and you would see that for that 25,000 ballots, you would need to review 315 of those ballots, and going across the top, if you had the 0.5% margin of victory, you would move to 0.4, which is, of course, a little bit tighter for your acceptance quality limit. And if you go down and you inspect your 315 ballots, if you have more than 3 rejects, I'm in the box that has a 2 and a 3, then the results are suspect and you would need to do additional work. If you have 3 or fewer changes to the vote totals in your recount, then you can assess that for any margin of victory greater than 0.4%, under tightened conditions, where we would probably want to be because this is a somewhat special situation and certainly critical, you could assess that, yes, my recount statistically matches my election night count. And so you have provided the counties far less or far fewer ballots to have to recount to arrive at the same result using an American National Standard method of doing so. Going back to the security, and this will certainly be more brief than my demonstration just now, once again, as I spoke to earlier, there are forensic tools that would allow the test board, the counties, or whomever, to obtain a snapshot image after the trusted build is loaded, and enable them to either reload that trusted build prior to running the absentee votes or an after-the-fact audit from the state to assess that the 400C had indeed, regardless of seals, which are quite adequate, and 24-hour video and the things that the counties are doing, which I will say are among the highest and tightest that I have witnessed in my election support duties across this country, you know absolutely 100% for sure. And I would even go so far as to say that loading a trusted image immediately prior to running the 400Cs invalidates the need for all of the rest of the stuff, or certainly would significantly reduce the need for it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Can I just add one comment on there? I don't think the testing board is hung up on the numbers, the exact numbers of ballots that have to be audited. So I definitely think that some research and tools, thank you, Mr. Smith, for providing those could be looked at. You know, the main goals from the testing board out of these requirements were kind of threefold. I mean, one, the audit needed to go all the way back to the WinEDS software rather than just at a device level. The second thing was to try to set the county up so it wouldn't be a rerun of the ballots. The current post-election audit law says that this is a reprocessing of the ballots. And here we're trying to do this from election night, from the original scanned ballots. So there was a lot of procedures to set that up. And then the final thing was just an overall increase in the number of ballots. And I think there is some legislation that's up for grabs, I guess, still being considered that may influence the outcome of that to some degree. But, you know, the current post-election audit rule says for central count machines, it's 20% of the ballots that were run not to exceed 500 ballots. So, you know, if a county does have 200,000 ballots, as was testified, the limit is 500 ballots currently, and I think the testing board wanted that number to somehow increase without putting burden on it, and that's why they came up with the chart. But certainly the numbers, you know, that's not as important as just achieving those three concepts.
Thank you.
I just have one comment. I would argue, though, that the rule that requires the number of ballots to be counted is addressing accuracy, whereas we're addressing security. So it's just two separate things.
Thank you.
The next part, I believe, is central count optical scan number 5 or 6. I'm not sure what the number is supposed to be. Administration rights restricted to one person. And management should act prudently in this area, and it should require a second person to have authorization to administer access to devices in case of emergency situations. I'm always concerned about one of my staff getting hit by a truck or having a heart attack, and then no one would be available to take over. So I would argue against that one. Okay.
Yeah, and just to confirm, we are agreeable to changing that to two persons globally.
Great. Thank you. And then talking about Edge 2, the external battery backup, do we need to talk about that more, considering we talked about
so.
With the Insight?
Same issue, I believe.
Okay. Our next one was number 6, DREs must be placed on a table. We find this to be unnecessary. First of all, we'd have to lease tables for the edges, which would be an additional cost, and the transportation cost to take them out there. And Denver had a situation or a solution where they used a pointer for the disabled to be able to use them, and they were quite acceptable with that, what they did with that. And the voter feedback regarding the pointers was very positive, and Faith Gross was agreeable with that also. So, okay.
And, Mr. Gardner. Thank you. Bill, I could just confirm that I think we'd be agreeable to having some optional language in there to use either or.
Oh, that would be great. Okay.
Thank you.
And the next override would be Sequoia again. Ed?
Thank you. I'll address the restriction of condition on use of Override INI. Override INI is a file utilized in the Sequoia architecture to provide an opportunity to override default audio and bitmap displays. For instance, we are the vendor of record for both City of Chicago and San Francisco, California. Chicago Chinese dialect is a little different than San Franciscan Chinese dialects, and there are different words for even such common things in the election as the name of a ballot. Thus, the Override INI file is used in these jurisdictions to provide bitmap displays on the screen, text inside of buttons that the voter would push on the screen, and even audio strings that the blind or illiterate voter would hear to call a ballot by its proper name for that jurisdiction. That is what override INI is used for. It is made to deal with state statutory specific requirements, such as in Colorado, the specific language on the VVPAT tape, for instance, which includes state of Colorado, which obviously people in California and Illinois, to continue with my example, probably would not want to see on their tapes. That is what override INI does. I know the test board has some concerns about its use. I have certainly noted those, and in my opinion, those can be mitigated by Sequoia providing to the test board a state of Colorado basic override.ini file, which could then be distributed by the state and changed and managed by the state as may be needed for statutory changes or particular county preferences going forward. We would certainly be available from our technical staff to aid with deriving additional or changed contents of the override INI file, which is simply a text file. It's viewable in a number of different applications on your PC. And thus the test board can see for themselves what is in there. They can take hashes of that file and ensure that it is what it purports to be throughout the election cycle for years to come. And so that is something Sequoia promotes as an option to these conditions, which are very restrictive to the counties and would limit their flexibility and, in fact, their ability to maintain statutory compliance where the system is capable of providing it through the use of override INI. Thank you.
The question I have, although maybe it's a question for Mr. Gardner, the condition says that editing the INI file can cause the Edge 2 plus to be inoperable. Do you know anything about that? I mean, is that, or maybe I should, again, maybe I should ask Mr. Gardner. I'm concerned that no matter how you do
I'll be happy to answer that. Yes, that's plausible, but unlikely, and there's never been any instance of it to date. I mean, for one, who that has access to it would wish to do that? And secondly, I'll go back to my BPS comment earlier and say, well, if you're going to require the counties to hand enter all this very deep and detailed election data, there's certainly a greater opportunity to have this army of temporaries do that rather than somebody who is in election administration fool around with the override INI file to do it. And they would have to know quite a lot about how the system works to do that, and frankly, our technical people deny that it's actually plausible to do that, because simply what you are doing is you have a file of lines and you have, for instance, text strings that say, instead of displaying press here to cast your vote, in the override INI file, perhaps the jurisdiction wants it to say, to cast your vote, press here. So the override INI file is an index that says, I know where this text string lives in the Edge 2 or Edge 2 Plus, and so I'm going to say this number, indexing to where that exists in the defaults of the Edge 2 and Edge 2 Plus, instead of saying what you normally would say by default, say this instead.
Okay. And I was overlooking the fact that this is really, I assume, a security thing. I was assuming this could happen inadvertently as well as maliciously, but that's just the, you know.
But once again, the output of the override INI file is self-evidencing.
Mm-hmm.
If someone misspells to cast your vote, press this button, and they only put one T in button, the jurisdictions will see that as part of the quality assurance prior to the election.
Okay.
If they provide the wrong dialect of language, once again, as the counties proof their audio, they would hear that.
Okay. Questions or comment, Mr. Gardner?
Thank you. I do have a few comments. The INI file, this is an initialization file. And this is another piece of potential software. And we say potential because Mr. Smith is correct. It is a text file. But it's a unique text file in that it has the ability to call instructions to other files. So we're stuck with a situation of the inability to verify the trusted build on the WinEDS server, and we're introducing a file, or the vendor would be introducing a file, or the county would be introducing a file, whomever, that has the ability to call files that we have not been able to verify to be trusted files after the point of deployment of the trusted build. With that said, the testing board was able to call files that didn't exist. An example was an image file. And during the voting process, the instructions that the DRE had was to call this image file. The image file didn't exist, and the machine locked up. You get an exception error when that happens, and thus the commas. But I think going back to Ed's original comment, if there is a way, and I think it's plausible that the state could create a static version, a trusted version of this INI file that the state could distribute to the counties as part of the trusted build package, that is a file that we could validate with hash values because it wouldn't change at the county level. And then maybe to get changes, the change control would take place by the state. So we would have the ability to recreate hash values and redistribute it with changes that are necessary based on legislation or county needs. And that would prevent, you know, that security inability or the demonstration that was provided by the test board.
And that's consistent with your suggestion, Ed?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe you want to step outside. Okay. The next one is 10B. Devices shall have lockable activate buttons. We'd actually like to be able to activate the Edge 2 voting machines manually. In Denver County, during the 2006 election, voters reported feeling more comfortable watching the judges put in the precinct number than using the card. And if the activator or the hat becomes inoperable, we'd like the ability to be able to use the manual activation button. If you will understand that our machines are set up so that the voter does not go to the back of the machine and activate the button. It's no different than our old Advantage machines where the judge activates the ballot that for the voter. The voter does not have access to that yellow button on the back of the machine. There's a curtain. The voter is before that. The button's on the back. The judge is always there. I feel that mitigates the issue with that. And to put seals on these machines would be an extra burden because they do have to reset the machines occasionally, or they have to do printer tests, and it would be another log, and the judges are already overburdened with everything they have to do.
Okay. Any comment or question, Mr. Gardner?
Sure. Thank you. The DRE machines by Sequoia do have a voter accessible control. Although it is in the back of the machine, it is not a stretch, I guess, to envision somebody reaching around this. We certainly have seen cases where the devices are set up in a fact where the queue line for voting is able to observe the judge using this button to activate the device. So without passwords, in a manual activation mode and the voter being aware of the button exposure on the back of the device, voting multiple times is a situation that could present itself, thus the concern. So we do think the lock on the device is very critical. I think we could look at the potential of using it as a backup if the hat or card activator failed, although the data we receive from the vendor indicates the reliability of these devices to be very high, so that means it would be very small. And maybe the seal is maybe over the top, and that should be considered if the seal on the key is necessary, because you do have the control of the key in the judge's hand, and maybe the seal over the lock is a bit much. So we could look at that part, I think.
I would argue a couple of things on that. First of all, have you ever had evidence that voters went behind the machines and activated and then ran around the front and voted on the machine numerous times? It just doesn't happen. The judges are there. They monitor it. Two parties, Democrats, Republicans, they're not going to let a voter, run around here, push the button, and then run back, because they can't do it through over the machine because there's a curtain there. There's a flap that comes up and protects the front from the back, or protects the back from the front. So voters just are not going to do that. So That's what I would have to say about that. Provide me evidence that it's happened, and then maybe we should do something about it.
Okay.
Right, okay. Yeah, we would like that as an option to be able to leave it so that we can operate these machines manually. Not an option. We don't want to seal the machine up to begin with. We want it as an option to use that. We used it extensively in Arapahoe County, and I know Denver County did too, in the last two elections, and it worked very, very well. We did not have any voters try to vote numerous times.
Okay. John, any further comment? I mean, I think we understand that one. Okay.
Okay, and then I don't know that we need to discuss 10C administration rights restricted to one person. We're okay with that, John? Okay. And then just as a follow-up, I'd like to read a little statement. In addition to reconsidering the above conditions, we would like the Secretary of State to consider certifying the EDGE 2 and EDGE 2 Plus with the following conditions. EDGE 2 was submitted to the Colorado Department of State for certification with a card activator. If the EDGE 2 is certified upon reconsideration, we request the ability to use the HAT 50 with the EDGE 2 as well. Three of the four Colorado counties using Sequoia equipment already have an inventory of HATs. Each of these three counties has used the HAT with the EDGE 2 in previous elections and have not experienced any issues with the HAT incorrectly activating the equipment.
Could you, I'm sorry, I'm being dense here, but say that again, what you want. You want to certify well, it looks like John can probably help me out.
Yeah, Nancy, I think the issue is you're looking for the cross-compatibility of the HAT or the card activator with either the EDGE 2 or the EDGE 2 Plus. And I think initially there was the restriction that the card activator could only be used with the EDGE 2 and the HAT could only be used with the EDGE 2 Plus. But you're saying you want to be able to use either one with either machine. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we're agreeable to that.
Okay.
Well, that was easier than I thought.
Me too.
Anything else?
That's it.
Thank you so much. Really, this was very helpful to have, for you to have gone through it so carefully and clearly of the things, that the conditions that you could agree with and try to winnow it down to the ones that really were problematic and the way you've organized it. I think that really is very, very helpful. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Is there any? I haven't gone through my sign-up sheets, but is there anybody else who wishes to comment, testify? And I don't see that there is anyone. So, Nancy, I don't know whether if you have anything in writing that you are going to leave with us. I don't know whether it looked like you had some materials you're reading from.
We do. We're still critiquing it just a bit.
Okay.
But we'll get it to you this afternoon.
Okay.
All the written documentation to support what we've talked about.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Well, if there's nothing further, then we'll conclude the hearing. The time is 11:21 a.m. Thank you all so much. I really do appreciate your coming here and helping explain the objections. Very helpful.